Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks for being here with us on this Friday afternoon, maybe Friday evening where you are, maybe even Saturday morning where you are, wherever you are. We're glad you're spending the time with us. We've got 2 hours with Jimmy Akin today, and ask him anything. If you've got a question for Jimmy Akin, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. But I was just telling Jimmy that a couple minutes before the show started, already all the lines were full. So people have questions for Jimmy Akin. Let me look right now. Yep, every single line full. So you'll just have to keep trying if you want to get in. We'll do our very best to get you on. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. He's got a newer podcast, the Jimmy Akin podcast, and he's got that big one, that one of the most popular documentary podcasts anywhere. It's Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Welcome back, Jimmy Akin.
Howdy. How's it going, Si?
Really good. Really good for a Friday. It's going pretty darn good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
All right. The number is 888-318-7884. Jimmy, today it dropped a new episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. What was it?
Well, so as you mentioned, I've got this new podcast, the Jimmy Akin podcast, and it comes out guaranteed on Mondays. It may come out on some other days, but this Monday, I looked at a passage in Romans called the Golden Chain of Salvation, which is often talked about by Calvinists who believe that it proves the perseverance of the saints, the idea that if you're ever in a state of grace, you will always remain in a state of grace. So it denies the possibility of mortal sin. That's what they think it means. But I go through the golden chain link by link and show you why they're misreading this passage. So that was the Jimmy Akin podcast this week. Today's episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is part two of our look at an early Christian apocalypse known as the Ascension of Isaiah. The first half of the book looks at the martyrdom of the prophet Isaiah, and the second half looks at Isaiah's ascension through the seven heavens. And both parts include traditions about Jesus that are not found in the Gospels. And what's interesting about this book is it is a first century book. It looks like it was written about the year of AD 67. So it is earlier than the book of Revelation, and it is contemporary with the four Gospels, but it contains traditions about Jesus that are not mentioned in them. So it makes for a very interesting read.
Ah, very good. Check it out. Mysterious.fm is where you can find Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, or just type in Jimmy Akin or Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You'll find all these things that Jimmy has available. Or just give us a call, 888-318-7884. Chris did in Ohio. He's listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Chris, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is in regards to making a valid confession. What is the necessary contrition one has to have? What is the necessary motivations for that contrition? And then what is the necessary resolution one has to make going forward?
Okay, so in terms of the necessary contrition, the technical term for the kind of contrition that suffices for a valid confession is attrition. Attrition is a repentance from sin based on something other than love of God. So it might be, for example, be fear of punishment. And so fear of being punished is sufficient for making a valid confession. Also disgust at the character of sin, that could be a motive for attrition, that would be valid for confession. If you have rejection of sin based on love of God, because he's the highest infinite most lovable thing, then you have not just attrition, but what's known as contrition. And if you have contrition, or perfect contrition, it's often called, if you have perfect contrition, then you're actually forgiven before you even go to confession, but you still need to go to confession. So the motives for attrition can be just about anything other than love of God. I should note that contrition and attrition do not exclude each other. So you can have both forms of repentance. You can both reject sin because you love God above all things, and at the same time be afraid of punishment, and at the same time be disgusted by sin and things like that. So they're not mutually incompatible. In terms of what resolution you need going forward, you need to have a resolution by God's grace to resist sin in the future. Now, this does not mean, as the Vatican has pointed out, that you have to promise you're never going to sin again, because, or mortally sin again, because people know themselves and they know, you know, I've got this besetting sin I've got to deal with. But it's sufficient if you reject that sin in the moment. So you say, I really don't want to do that again. I recognize I may get tempted and fall into it again, but as of right now, I really don't want to do that again, and I ask God to give me the grace to help me not do that again.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's very helpful. Is when we talk about attrition or contrition, and we're rejecting our old sins, aside from the motivation, are we rejecting them in the sense that we regret them, or we reject them as like we wish we wouldn't have done them, or is there a specific
In the moment, we reject them in the sense, this is part of what attrition and perfect contrition are. It incorporates the resolution. So it is, I wish I had not done them. I may on an emotional level kind of be glad I did, but as an act of the will, I turn my will away from them. I wish I had not done them in the past. I wish I will not do them in the future, even though I may have some emotional attachment to them in the present, or even though I recognize I may get tempted in the future. As of right now, I turn my will away from them and reject them.
Chris, thank you. I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you very much for the question. We have time to get another one in before the break. And Joseph is in Brooklyn, New York, watching on YouTube. Welcome, Joseph. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Can you hear me?
Yep. What's your question?
Jimmy, I have a Protestant friend who said that St. Augustine said that when Jesus was talking about being born of water, that it was a physical rebirth, not baptism. Did St. Augustine actually say that?
A physical rebirth? You mean you... How would that work?
Yeah, you know, Protestants believe that when Jesus was talking about being born of water and spirit, that they believe that the water part was the breaking of the female amniotic sac when
fluid. Okay, when she gives birth. I just want to clarify this. I think you may have misspoken. You said a physical rebirth as opposed to a physical birth. First of all, this is not all Protestants. This is actually a comparatively small number of Protestants who hold this view. Most Protestants believe, just like Catholics do, that we are regenerated in baptism. And so this is not universally the Protestant view. Your friend obviously belongs to a tradition that is either Baptist or was influenced in its history by Baptists, because that's where you really get this view. In terms of, did St. Augustine say that the passage in John, in John 3, about must be born of water and the Spirit, and the water referring to amniotic fluid. Did he say that? Well, I would be very interested to see. I'd need a reference for that. You know, Augustine wrote voluminous amounts of stuff, and he said different things in different places. And towards the end of his career, he even wrote a book called Retractations, meaning rewritings, where he would change what he had previously said a little bit in light of his more mature thought. I'm not aware of a passage where he does that. If he has one, it wouldn't mean that he rejected the idea of baptismal regeneration, because one of the things you find when you study early church fathers, including St. Augustine, is that they had what is called a polyvalent understanding of Scripture, meaning you could look at a passage and it can mean more than one thing. So just because he may, and I don't know that he did this, but if he looked at this text and saw in it a reference to physical birth, that doesn't mean that he rejected the idea of baptismal salvation. I would be astonished if he did that, because, among other things, a number of years ago, I did a detailed study using computer software of every reference to this verse in the Church Fathers, and I could not find anybody who rejected the idea that it refers to water baptism. So I would be astonished if St. Augustine did, but I would have to see the reference to check it out. I would invite your friend, if you want to follow this up, to name the passage and look it up. And once you've looked it up, or if you can't find it, you know, you could email us and let me know what the passage is so I can look it up, and then you could call back and we could examine it.
Joseph, we'll leave it there. I hope that that was helpful to you, but we have to take a quick break. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
This is Conversations with Consequences, where we delve deeper into issues affecting our church, our country, and our core, the family.
As Catholics, we need to be informed, aware, and able to talk through some of the tough topics that we're facing in our culture and in our world. Conversations with Consequences gives us the tools to do so.
It's not enough to pray. We have to be a light for the world.
Conversations with Consequences, tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, all the lines full at the moment. It's an Ask Me Anything today. You can call and ask Jimmy whatever you like. You don't have to be Catholic to call. Anybody can call. If you want to know about the Bible, you want to know about Jesus, you want to know about the sacraments, you've got a question about the moral life or anything else, you're welcome to call. As lines up, we'll get you on with Jimmy. 888-318-7884. There's a big sale going on at shop.catholic.com right now. It's the annual fall sale. And each year, everything is put on sale. Everything at shop.catholic.com, from 10 to 25% off. In some cases, even more than 25% off. All you got to do is head over and take a look, see what you. And they got everything there now. We got merchandise. We got Christmas gifts. And we got all the books and the CDs and the DVDs. And do we still have DVDs? Maybe I'm exaggerating. Digital products. I'll just call it that. Just go to shop.catholic.com and find out what's available and get your savings now. We're going up to Newfoundland, Canada now. Colin, watching on our website, catholic.com. Glad to have you, Colin. Thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. So within Catholic culture, how would it be received to include a future fictional Marian apparition as background world building within a work of science fiction, given that by, say, the 23rd century, you might expect there to be significant apparitions, maybe even on the moon or Mars, but at the same time, I could see it being a bit of a faux pas, as we don't want to introduce big ideas into things that are associated with Marian apparitions in culture. I would just be interested for your thoughts on the matter.
Well, as long as you're not doing a Dan Brown and trying to portray your fiction as if it's based on fact, you know, which is what he did with the Da Vinci Code. It was a totally fictional premise, but he tried to portray it as if it was based on fact. Then the audience is not going to be confused about, oh, okay, there was a Marian apparition on the moon or on Mars or wherever. In fact, we would expect that to happen anywhere Catholics, you know, and other Christians who honor Mary go. And so, you know, the reaction would vary by individuals, but I don't think very many people would mind. In fact, I think a lot of them would appreciate seeing a Catholic presence, including via Marian apparitions in the future in the science fictional universe you write in. In fact, I've planned to do that myself. I'll tell you what I've planned, and of course you can't use it because this is my idea, but I have for years thought about writing a set of stories where we have not exactly a jump drive, but a means of traveling faster than light. And in this universe, on the very first usage of the drive to carry a human being, a Marian apparition occurred. And the way the drive works is it casts you up out of three-dimensional Einsteinian space into higher dimensions, and then you fall back down into Einsteinian space. And so the first astronaut to test pilot this drive, I was going to give him a mixed Hispanic and Chinese name, you know, like Miguel Chin or something like that, because in the future we're going to have more and more, you know, people from different ethnic backgrounds, Marian. Miguel Chin, or whatever I would name him, had a Marian apparition when he was at the peak of his trajectory through these higher dimensions. And the Marian apparition became known as Our Lady of Highest Heavens. And Our Lady of Highest Heavens gave him a message of blessing to humanity from her son as mankind travels through these higher physical heavens. And the symbol of Our Lady of Highest Heavens, which then became a traditional symbol that you would see on any faster than light spaceship, whether the people were Catholic or not on the ship, was a tesseract, you know, the three-dimensional image of a four-dimensional cube with the Virgin Mary within the tesseract. And so that was my idea for Our Lady of Highest Heavens. And so I think people would have a good reaction to that.
All right, Colin.
That's awesome. Though acclaimed Catholic apologist Jimmy Akin should know better than to make fun of renowned Dan Brown.
Yeah, his insect eyes might flash like a rocket.
Colin, I'm going to say thank you. Get to writing, man. You got a few more hours before midnight. This is this is prime time for a writer like yourself. Get to work. Jimmy Akin.
And just to clarify, what Colin was referring to is a number of years ago, there was a newspaper article that came out in a British newspaper. It was like called Don't Make Fun of Renowned Dan Brown, that viciously mocked Dan Brown's writing style. and it used, because Dan Brown has a bunch of writing flaws. He's actually a terrible writer. I used to hang out on linguistics boards where the linguists would make fun of him because of how horrible his prose style is. And he would mix metaphors and say things like, his insect eyes flashed like a rocket.
That is a great mixed metaphor, if you're doing it on purpose. Colin, thanks again. Let's go to Zach in Iowa now, watching on YouTube. Zach, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Okay. Today I was puzzled over Luke. The book of Luke in section 11.
You mean chapter 11?
Yeah, 15 through like, yeah, 23. I always found it odd that Jesus argued that Satan couldn't win by dividing Satan, when it could easily be argued that, at least at the time, that Jesus was acting as a red herring, or the, the demon was acting as a red herring. It waits for Jesus to shoo him away, it leaves, and Jesus looks like a hero, and hence the divine image of Satan being held up or encouraged again. And I know he kind of covers that, whereas then a demon and would leave, come back, find where he resided.
Zach, I think I have the gist of your question. Let me have a shot at answering it. So you're asking about the passage where Jesus is accused of driving out demons by Beelzebul, the prince of the demons. And the people who are criticizing him in that way are making exactly the charge that you say. That's what they think. He's using demonic power to drive out demons. And Jesus says that is not the case. And to help us understand why it's not the case, he gives us an insight into how the demonic world operates. He says an army divided against itself, a house divided against itself cannot stand. And so if Satan casts out Satan, meaning if one demon casts out another, then Satan's kingdom is divided and it's going to come to an end. And so the basic idea he's got here is that the kingdom of Satan works like other kingdoms. They've got an army that does the bidding of the king, but if the army is fighting against itself, the kingdom is going to be unstable and fall. And so Satan is not stupid. He's not going to let his troops get into disarray and start fighting each other. Satan imposes order on his kingdom, because if he didn't, there would be a civil war in the demonic realm and his kingdom would fall. He doesn't want his kingdom to fall, so he imposes order on it the same way a human king doesn't want his kingdom to fall, because it gets into a civil war. And so human kings impose order on their kingdoms and their troops. And Jesus says the same thing is true of Satan. Incidentally, I actually talk about this in today's episode of Mysterious World, because as the prophet Isaiah is ascending through the seven heavens, he first has to ascend through the firmament where the demons live, and he sees the demons in conflict with each other. And this is one of the elements in the book that indicates it's written independently of the Gospels. It is very early, from before the Gospels were universally recognized as authoritative, because three of the four Gospels have this same passage. You know, all three of the synoptics indicate that Satan imposes order on his troops, and yet the author of the Ascension of Isaiah takes an opposite view and thinks that the demons are up in the firmament fighting each other. So that's an indication that this book is extremely early, but it doesn't have the tradition that we find in the synoptic gospels, which is what we can have confidence in. Jesus knows more about the demonic realm and how it operates than any of us here on earth, and he assures us it functions like an ordered kingdom that is not in the middle of a civil war.
Zach, thank you very much for the question. I hope that was helpful to you. Our lines are full, so on we go. Elias is in Glendora, California, watching on YouTube. Elias, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Oh, yeah, my question is, when it comes to noticing coincidences, I've been having a recurring thing where I notice certain combinations of numbers that I associate certain narratives, and I see them come repeatedly. I'm wondering, and sometimes it's even things that are just in my own mind, and I know the demons, from what I understand, according to Gabriel of Morris, they can't hear our thoughts. So I'm wondering, how is it that these coincidences occur? I can give you an example of, say, a license plate matches my odometer at a certain time, and then, you know, just over and over. And how do I know, is this coming from heaven or from hell, or what is it? Or is it just the mind is able to pick up on a pattern through patternicity?
Okay, so we may hit the break here, and I may have to finish on the other side, but when it comes to spot and coincidences, most of them are just that. They are things that just happen to coincide, and there is no special meaning to them. When there is a special meaning that a person perceives behind a coincidence, it's what's known, based on the work of Carl Jung, as a synchronicity. But most coincidences, a synchronicity is a meaningful coincidence. But most coincidences are not meaningful. They're just random happenstance. When it comes to noticing them regularly, there is a cognitive bias that comes into play known as confirmation bias. Confirmation bias occurs when you believe or expect something to happen, and then when it, and then you tend to read things as confirming that. So if you, there's a famous one for like noticing the number 11, and after people start noticing the number 11, it becomes reinforcing. And every time they encounter an 11, it pops up to the top of their consciousness as, oh, there's another 11, and they attribute significance to it. There's more to say, but I'll say it on the other side of the break.
I hope you can hang on. Elias will continue with Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Deepen your connection to the Church's holy days and seasons while you draw on the wisdom of the Church Fathers. Feasts of Our Fathers, the new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, is a treasury of history, prayers, insights, and lessons that will bring you closer to the earliest of Catholic traditions. Take your prayer life and your solidarity with the Church, past and present, to a new level. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers today at shop.catholic.com.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
I'm Deacon Harold Burke Sivers. Join me for Beacon of Truth today at 4 p.m. Eastern.
On the next Beacon of Truth, praying for your enemies and Soulful Psalm 74.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Elias and Glendora on the line with Jimmy Akin. It's Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin this hour and next on Catholic Answers Live. And Elias wants to know what to make of coincidence. How should we think of coincidence as Catholics?
Yeah, so a lot of noticing coincidence is just down to confirmation bias. Once you've noticed this, you tend to keep, and you attribute some significance to it, you tend to keep noticing it. And it's just random. Now, that's not to say God can't, you know, generate synchronicities or allow for synchronicities. It is possible. But I would say you need something really unusual, you know, something that just appears to go beyond random chance. You know, having a license plate sync up kind of with your odometer. You know, there's probably some letters in that license plate in addition to numbers, at least here in the U.S. And those numbers, those letters probably aren't on your odometer. So this is just a partial match. And partial matches are going to be common. If something really, though, is off the charts, then it could have a paranormal explanation. That explanation could be God. It could, or his angels. It could be demons, but that's very unlikely. We don't have any. That's not a known mode of demonic behavior. In order to propose that something is demons, you need evidence that it's demons. And the way to do that is this something we know demons do, as opposed to just speculating it could be demons? And we don't know that demons arrange coincidences like this. That's not a historical mode of behavior that demons engage in. Elias mentioned that Gabriel Amorth said demons can't read our thoughts, and that is a common opinion among theologians going back to St. Thomas Aquinas. However, I personally disagree because spirits are telepathic beings. And, you know, angels and demons, they communicate by telepathy. And so you would expect them to be able to read minds. But and the arguments that they don't are based on a misinterpretation of a Bible verse that doesn't really mean what various theologians have thought. However, even theologians like St. Thomas Aquinas, who did think that demons can't technically read your thoughts, believed that they could deduce your thoughts based on observing your behavior. And today we know that our thoughts are mirrored in the neurology of our brains. And so, you know, demons can see matter in ways that we can't. They can presumably read your brain patterns, you know, what neurons are firing, just like an MRI could. So I don't think we can have any confidence that demons can't read our thoughts. They obviously can, you know, even if they can't technically read our thoughts, they can do things that approximate reading our thoughts. And but I just don't think we need to worry about that because we have God's protection. And so we shouldn't be concerned about it. My first thought would not be demons in the case of an off the charts, totally not random chance coincidence. I would think maybe God did it, or because theologians like St. Thomas Aquinas and Pope St. Gregory the Great were open to what today would be called psychic functioning, like St. Thomas Aquinas was open to precognition, which he called natural prophecy to distinguish it from the supernatural prophecy that God gives. Maybe it's your own psychic functioning, you know, especially if the coincidence doesn't seem to have any, you know, religious orientation, because what God cares about is religion, you know, and helping people out and things like that. And if something is really weird, but doesn't seem oriented towards helping you in some way, especially religiously, I would tend to think maybe it's just your own psychic functioning if it goes beyond random chance. But most of the time, coincidences are just random chance, and our noticing of them is fed by confirmation bias.
And I will leave that there, hoping that that is helpful to you. Elias, thank you very much for the call. We go now to, it must be Saturday morning in Seoul, South Korea. Not even 8 o'clock in the morning yet, and Luke is on the line. Hello, Luke. Welcome back. No?
Hello, Joe.
Oh.
Good morning.
Oh, this is Cy, and you're on with Cy and Jimmy. You got a question for Jimmy?
Oh, yeah. Good morning, Jimmy. Good morning.
Howdy.
All right, so Jimmy, I've got in a disagreement with a friend about Sunday masses. So basically, she moved to a new place, and according to her, the church is very far away from her. And when she attends She doesn't get anything from the mass. So she told me that she's going to stop going for Sunday masses and maybe just listening to mass online. Well, I told her that it's compulsory, like it's obligatory for Catholics to attend mass every Sunday. Mm-hmm. So her dispute is that if she's going to the mass on Sunday and not getting anything, so she's just trying to keep like a man-made obligation, a man-made rule. So I didn't know the answer to give her for that. So yeah, that's my question.
Okay, well, Luke, I'm afraid I couldn't understand all of your question, but I'll do the best I can with it. So in the first place, your friend is thinking about mass the wrong way around. And she's thinking about it in terms of the only reason to go to mass is for me to get something out of it. And that's a self-centered version of going to mass, where I need to get something out of it if I'm going to go to it. That is not what mass is about. That is a backwards way of thinking about the mass. The mass is not about going to get something out of it, you know, some feelings or whatever. The mass is about not about you. It's about God. The reason we go to mass is to worship God. And yes, we also get some things out of mass, like we hear his word and we receive prayers from others that we pray in union with. And of course, we receive Jesus Christ himself in the Eucharist. All of those are things that we get, but the reason we go to mass is to worship God. And so she's thinking about mass backwards, as if it's about getting something for herself, like certain feelings or things like that. And that's not what it is at all. In terms of why Sunday mass or, you know, Saturday evening mass is obligatory, well, because worshiping God is a grave obligation. He is, God is infinitely good. We owe him literally everything, and we need to testify to his worth because he deserves it. And worshiping, we don't just worship God as individuals because humans are social creatures. You know, we're social animals. We're meant to worship God corporately. And that's why the Jewish people had the Sabbath ordained for them as a day for corporate worship of God. And that was a grave obligation for them. And in the same way, when Jesus rose from the dead, the apostles chose that as the day for corporate worship for Christians. And just as the Sabbath was a grave obligation, because it's just a grave obligation, we need to devote time to corporate worship, so for the Christian Sunday, it's a day of grave obligation because that's how much God deserves our worship.
Luke, I'll tell you what, I think I'm going to continue to just leave it there and wish you a wonderful weekend and hope we'll talk to you again soon. But boy, the lines are staying full. So on we go. And we come back here to Southern California, where Chris is watching on YouTube. Chris, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
You mean me?
Yes, you, Chris. Go ahead with your question.
Okay, Mr. Aiken, like, is it morally just for a government to outlaw collective bargaining or even like certain types of labor unions such as public employee unions?
Well, the church wants to see everybody have a right to negotiate their situation with their employers, and that can be handled a number of different ways. It can be handled through individual negotiation, or it can be handled through collective negotiation. And so in the main, the church would support the existence of labor unions. However, that doesn't mean that there are no limits to that. If a particular type of labor union, or even a particular labor union that's, you know, not of a particular type, it's just one labor union, is being fundamentally disruptive that's harming the common good of society, then the state is not required, I would say, by Catholic moral theology to support the existence of that labor union if it's fundamentally harming the good of society, because the whole purpose of labor unions and individual negotiation, they're both meant to help the common good. And if in a particular situation or a particular class of situations, the common good is being harmed rather than helped, then you're not required to support the institution that that is producing that harm. So being strictly neutral here, if individual bargaining is harming the common good, then you could prohibit individual bargaining. And if collective bargaining is harming the common good, then you could prohibit collective bargaining in those situations. When it comes to like a public sector labor union, I think there is an interesting argument that they actually do harm the common good. Because they are negotiating with the government that has the power of taxation, and they can become very powerful and have an influence on the government that is independent of the voters. And through that, they can try to feather their own nests in a way that harms the vote in public. And so I think there's an interesting argument for outlawing public sector labor unions of government employees, but I haven't formed any firm conclusions about that.
You know what, Chris, thank you very much for that. We got to take a quick break. We will be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley of the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul? And that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Wings is a weekly newsletter that's packed with program information, features, and updates of all that's going on at EWTN. To sign up, go to EWTN.com, click subscribe, enter your name and email address, and you'll start getting your wings every week. Get your wings today. It's the weekly newsletter from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. There's a line open. It's the first time today we have a line open. So if you have a question for Jimmy Akin, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. We're going now to Levi in Virginia, listening on our website, catholic.com. Levi, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. I'm sorry. Okay. What I meant to say was hi. The peace of Christ be with both you, Cy, and with you, Jimmy.
Thank you, Levi.
What's your question, Levi?
Well. Oh, okay. Sorry. I didn't know we needed to cut to the chase.
Yep.
Well, Jimmy, first of all, I just want to say I'm a big fan of your work, but I'll go ahead cut to my question.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy, I know that considering the fact that you do a lot of apologetics work, you would argue that the people who read this should look into and join the Catholic Church, correct?
If I'm doing my job right, yeah.
Okay, well, I say this because as a Baptist who has been learning about the Catholic Church, studying about the church and church history, there is just one thing about even the possibility of conversion that's always just kind of thrown me off.
Uh-huh.
And that is the church seems to go through a lot of struggles, mm-hmm. Whether that be historically with the lead up to the Council of Nicaea and the Arian controversy, and even recent examples, you know, take your pick. You know, it's this kind of thing of considering how shaky sometimes the church seems to be, whether that be holding to doctrinal standards, holding to moral standards, or whatever. What then would really be your argument to say, I understand that this seems shaky, but, you know, still, you should still become Catholic.
All right. I'm going to let Jimmy answer, because that was a very clear question.
Well, so if I understand the premise of your question correctly, you note variability where there has been confusion in the church, including coming from some churchmen. You mentioned, for example, at the Council of Nicaea, and it's true there was confusion, including from some churchmen, both before and after the Council of Nicaea. And that's not unique to that time period. It's all the way down through history. I would say a couple of things, at least a couple of things. The first one is this is not unique to the Catholic Church. This is everybody. You mentioned you happen to come from the Baptist tradition, and if you study the history of the Baptist tradition, you will find exactly the same thing. To cite just one memorable example, the Baptist churches in America split at the time of the Civil War, and they split over, among other things, the issue of slavery. And you had Northern Baptists who opposed slavery, whereas Southern Baptists tended to support it. And that was a major rift in the Baptist community. You look more recently and you see a liberalization in various parts of the Baptist community in the 20th century, where they become progressively more open to items that deviate from the historic Christian faith. And so this confusion in churches is not something that the Catholic Church ought to be singled out for. If it prevented you from becoming a Catholic, it should equally well prevent you from becoming a Baptist or a Presbyterian or an Orthodox or an anybody, because confusion is part of the human condition. And knowing that, what we need to do is figure out what Jesus wants. And when we study what Jesus wants, he wanted to have a church that was a visible institution. You can show this from the Gospel of Matthew, which contains the only two passages where Jesus actually mentions his church. It's Matthew 16 and Matthew 18. He wanted to have a church that's a visible institution, and we can tell from these passages that it's a visible institution that has an official membership, it has leaders, it has followers, it has excommunication. It has laws that the leaders are create and the followers are expected to obey. It's supposed to be founded on Peter in a unique sense, and it's supposed to go from the first century to today, because he says to Peter, on you I'm going to build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it, meaning my church is never going to die. So in order to find Jesus's church, we need to look for a visible institution that has leaders and followers and laws and excommunication that has existed since the first century and that is built in a unique way on Peter. And that just points to the Catholic Church. And then within that, we can recognize, okay, but there's going to be confusion. Just like there was confusion in the first century, including among churchmen. You know, St. Paul talks about the false apostles and false preachers that were deceiving people even in the first century, and that has continued down through the ages. But what we've got is Jesus promising that the Holy Spirit will lead the disciples into all truth, and he himself promises, that's in John, and he himself promises at the end of Matthew that he will be with his followers, guiding them through to the end of the world. So, you know, that's going to apply to his church. And so even if there are ups and downs and confusion at various points, Jesus has promised that he and the Holy Spirit are going to guide his church, and that's going to continue to the end of time. So once we've identified his church, we can be confident that he's still guiding it despite all of the confusion that Satan and just human fallenness can generate. If you'd like to read more about that, I have a paper on my website, jimmyakin.com, called Why Be Catholic? An Exercise for Evangelicals. It'll go through the basics of the argument that I just made in a lot more detail. So I suggest you check that out. Once again, it's called Why Be Catholic? An Exercise for Evangelicals. It's at jimmyakin.com. And also, I wrote a book called A Daily Defense, and I think we can send you that, and it deals with a lot of objections that you might like to see Catholic responses to.
Just all you have to do if you'd like a copy of that book, A Daily Defense, just hang on the line. We'll get an address, and we'll send it out to you. And thank you very much for the call. On we go.
I hope that helps, Levi, and please feel free to call me again.
I hope it helps as well, Levi. We're going to Steve in Pennsylvania now, watching on YouTube. Steve, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Hi, Si.
Howdy.
First time caller.
Oh, well, we're happy you're here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've seen videos online of Calvinists arguing that the Book of Jonah is evidence against free will.
What would
be the Catholic argument against that?
Well, I can't tell you the Catholic argument because the church doesn't have a teaching on this, but I can tell you what I would say in response to it. The first thing I'd say is this is an experiment where you have one test subject, N equals one. The number of test subjects equals one in this argument. And you can't build an inductive case based on one example. You would need loads of examples in order to build an inductive case, and this argument therefore has no evidential force. There's a second reason that the argument has no evidential force, and that is that there is a mismatch between what happens in the Book of Jonah and the Calvinistic understanding of causation. According to Calvinists, God gives people a grace that will unfailingly ensure that they turn to him and remain in a state of grace for the rest of their lives. Okay, that is not what's happening with Jonah. There's no discussion of him being in a state of grace in that book. But more fundamentally, on the Calvinist understanding of how the will works, God operates on the will itself. He doesn't do things from the outside. Calvinists will frequently say that they believe in a form of free will that's compatible with divine determinism, and they'll say, you're not forced. God is not forcing you to become a Christian. He's not making you do anything you don't want to do. He's given you the desire to become a Christian, and then you just freely follow your greatest desire. Well, okay, so if God is operating directly on the human will and not, you know, punching you around to get you to become a Christian, that doesn't fit what happens with Jonah. God tells Jonah to go to Nineveh. Jonah doesn't want to go to Nineveh. Jonah runs away, and then God has this whole series of external events to beat Jonah into going to Nineveh after all when he doesn't want to. And Jonah even complains at the end of the book, saying, I didn't want to come here. I knew you were going to be merciful to these people. Okay, so God is forcing Jonah to act against his will. Jonah doesn't want to be there. Jonah doesn't want to do this. But that's exactly not what Calvinists understand God to be doing with our wills. And so there's a fundamental mismatch between what happens to Jonah and what Calvinists say happened with our wills. And so those are the two main points I would make. Whenever you've got an experiment where you've got one test case, you cannot make an inductive argument on that. And there's a fundamental difference between the kind of causation that Calvinists hold happens with us and the kind of causation that happened with Jonah.
Steve, all that makes sense to you?
Yeah, that was really helpful.
All right. Well, Jimmy tends to do that. I'm glad you were here. Thanks. Father Tom in Iowa, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. I'm sorry, Father, but if you have to be quick if you'd like an answer from Jimmy this hour.
Hey, Jimmy. Thank you. I just wanted to ask about how one would form their conscience in the church. And then if they have a formed conscience, could they, in good faith, if they follow their conscience, reject some sort of church teaching?
Okay.
Okay. So I'll need to be quick in this answer. The first thing I'd say is you want to read a document that came out in 1990 from the then Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. The document's title is Donum Veritatis, which means the gift of truth. And this document is about the role of the theologian in the church. And it talks about how to deal with doctrinal difficulties. So, you know, the different steps that you need to go through in dealing with them. Fundamentally, it is possible for Catholics in good conscience to disagree with non-infallible teachings as an exceptional matter, but not as an ordinary matter. And there are certain steps you need to go through as part of that process, but they're described in more fullness in Donum Veritatis. And I think I heard the music come in there, so I better shut my mouth and let you go read the document.
Thank you, Father Tom.
Also, read my book, Teaching with Authority, because I go into all this there in even more detail.
Let's send him a copy of that, because I kind of gave him short shrift. I'm not so good with the clock on that one, Father, and I apologize. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.